This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
How can these people point the gun at us, tell us to leave our home? Unbelievable, it's not true.
There's no housing for you, and you've got one day to make your own house. And the next day, we just got to work in the field, hard labor.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. Welcome to episode 3 of Learning from Genocide. Today, we'll be hearing from two people who will share what happened to them and their families after the Khmer Rouge took over the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh on the 17th of April, 1975, ending the Cambodian Civil War. With a Khmer Rouge victory imminent, the United States government evacuated US nationals and allied Cambodians on 12th of April, 1975. 5 days later, the last defences around Phnom Penh were overrun and the Khmer Rouge occupied the city. This was the beginning of a nightmare for the 2 million people who lived there, who were ordered to evacuate, many of them on foot, to the Cambodian countryside. Sok Pao Din and Ramoni Sim are just two of the people who left their homes forever that day. And in this episode, you'll hear their harrowing and heartbreaking stories. Sok Pao Din was a 17-year-old boy in 1975 with aspirations of training as a doctor. His father died when he was 6, but his mother remarried, and so he lived a comfortable life in the city with his mother, stepfather, and 3 younger siblings. And he's here with me now. Sok Pao, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rachel.
Could you start by telling us a little bit about your life in Phnom Penh before 1975? So where did you live? Who was in your family? What did your parents do?
I enjoy my school, my friend at school, everything else, my study, my house just behind the Royal Palace. As a young age, I never have any depressed or upset, just full of joy every day. Look forward to go to school, come back from school, stay with my mother and my grandmother, who she was staying with us. All my friends at school, they are great, and I enjoy my education. And I always have kind of look forward to do next. My education getting higher, I pass my diploma and look forward to do university. My dream is to want to be a doctor. I got my cousins, so many of them, and my uncles around me. And I got a comfortable home, comfortable family, plenty of food in Cambodia. So happy up to 1970 when we had a revolution, which is we changed the country to republic. That due to the war between American with North Vietnam, Viet Cong, and the Viet Cong invaded in Cambodian border. And then American entered Cambodia to fight with Viet Cong by using Cambodia as their base. And then at that time, General Lon Nol, which is the head of Cambodian Republic, and changed Cambodia to a Republic of Cambodia in 1970. So from 1970 up to 1975, the trouble began.
What kind of things were happening at that time that may have been unsettling?
Basically, it's down to the war. And at that time, I did not know what is about the communists, about Pol Pot at all. That we never heard of, never seen them. We just heard they were the fighting near the border of Cambodia, which is the villages away from Phnom Penh. And we heard how many people been killed. These villages has been damaged and burned the house down, everything. And it was horrible news. And also, some time to time, the people came in and threw the grenade in the market, in any public place like cinemas. They caused so much trouble inside Phnom Penh to stir up all our peaceful life.
So things were gradually getting more and more unstable around you. Can you tell us about the morning when your life changed forever?
That morning, on the 17th of April, 1975, myself, my brothers, two brothers, and my sister, we were in the kitchen about to having breakfast. My father wasn't home. He's at his base because in 1970 to 75, everyone have to join the army. If they need you to go to battlefield, you're ready to go to battlefield. A student have to train to become commando, ready to fight, ready how to use the gun, everything. So he was at his base. I was with my mother about to eat my breakfast. I heard the banging noise. Somebody slammed the door, like the front door. I said, what's that noise in the morning? It's 6 o'clock. So I went up there to have a look. I saw two persons with the black uniform with a red scarf on their neck. They both pointed the gun at me. I can see clearly what they looked like. They were very angry, miserable face, hatred, unpleasant. They just tell me, get out of your house now. Don't lock the door. Don't close the window. Don't do anything. Left it open. Get out of it now before I shoot you.
So out of the blue, someone is pointing a gun, threatening to shoot you. What was going through your mind at that moment?
At the time, I felt shocked and saying, how come this happened? You know, you could not believe it. It could be the dream or something just happening. I said to them, yes, I will do that. Then they moved to another house, which is next door. So I went back straight to my mum and I told her what happening. So my mother was panicked about it. And she sent someone to my father's base with some clothes for him to change because he hadn't got any civilian clothes. If he'd been seen in an army uniform, the Pol Pot soldier will arrest him and he will be taken away and you never seen again.
So at this point, you're having to pack at a moment's notice to leave your home.
My mother, when all this trouble happened, she prepared, the Cambodian woman wears sarong. So inside her sarong, she made four pockets. She one pocket for the gold only, second pocket for jewelry like diamonds and everything else. She split it in four pockets, all valuable things. She didn't have any money with her. All our belongings, which is our house deed or the land, everything, we just locked inside the safe at home. We just jumped in the car to my uncle's house, which is about 10 miles away, under the side of Phnom Penh. We just meet our people over there. At the time, we didn't know what we're going to do. No one ever dreamed that it's beginning of the nightmare. Beginning of the killing field or beginning of the genocide. We never thought, never believed that at all. How could we believe that someone could send everyone out of the city by saying American is going to bomb the city in a minute because they lost the war? We have to get out of the city to the villages.
And they initially told you that you would only have to evacuate for a few days.
About 2-3 days and you all will come back home. You don't have to take anything at all. Just go, what they say to us. They lie to us about that. And we try to believe, yeah, it may be true. No one ever leave home. We are home. We're born here. We live here at home. How can these people point the gun at us, tell us to leave our home? Unbelievable. It's not true. We got four families, four uncles who came from different areas to meet up with my uncle. House. So we prepared that night. We just get some rice, grain, any food that we can take with us. We just get some mosquito net, blankets, and pots and pan. We don't even think about getting spoon or plate, anything. We just said, well, only a few days we'll be back. And also the whole country would have some shops and things like that. You know, we don't need to worry about it. It was wrong, unfortunately.
And what happened when you got to your uncle's house?
Myself and my cousin, he's about 1 year, 2 years older than me. We sneak out of the house on a motorbike back to my house because I miss a few things with my books. I didn't have any clothes with me and I want to see my dog. So I went back home and I saw my dog, which is white dog, her name Lila. And I say goodbye to her, tap her and say, stay here, be safe. I'll be back in a few days. I was in tears. I pulled some food for my dog and left home. From that day, I never seen her again and I don't know what happened to her.
It must have been heartbreaking to leave your dog behind. And when you arrived back at your uncle's, what was going on there?
That night we stayed overnight, but we could hear there's so many gun shooting, rockets, bombs everywhere. That night we couldn't sleep at all. We can smell the gunpowder. We can smell the burning house, the whole city. It's a horrible scene you cannot describe. And as a 17 years old, I never feel that's happened to me. So I don't have time to panic, to cry, to say anything, to think about anything. We just try to survive. But we're going to follow the order. If we don't follow, then we'll be dead. Next morning, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, we heard the shouting at the front gate. Two soldiers, which is one is a woman with her like rocket launcher, which is on her shoulder, pointed to us, to our house. Leave the house right now. Otherwise, I will shoot this rocket and kill you all. My father, myself, everything, we just panicked. My mother and my uncles begging them, said, please, please give us a chance. So we opened the gate. I mean, you couldn't believe on the main road, it already packed already. On bicycle, some of them on the chariot, they make up something or they carry with their shoulder. And some elderly, they carry on the hammock. And some people on the wheelchair, the young, the old, the baby crying, the pregnant woman. Even see people on the hospital bed with the drip with them. They push it along the main road. Where are we going? Where are we doing? We don't know where we're going. So we just follow everyone on the road as directed or instructed by the Pol Pot soldier. For every corner, they were there. They're watching you. The black uniform with angry face, not friendly at all. And with the guns pointing to us, it's a horrible scene. I can smell the blood. I've seen people being arrested on the street. They're just shouting at you and tell you to move on.
The genocide lasted from 1975 to 1979. Could you just try and take us through what you were feeling over the next 4 years? What happened to the rest of your family? How did you survive?
As soon as we get out of Phnom Penh, we just settled somewhere in the villages. First of all, they told my mother and father, saying, you're better off to come forward and tell us who you are. My uncle is a doctor, the bankers or teacher or soldier, including my father, my stepfather. We all came forward and told them in hope that we will go back to Phnom Penh again after our join the Pol Pot communists. They will accept us as a brainwash and they will allow us to come back to our house in Phnom Penh. But unfortunately, it was wrong. They took 4 uncles, 2 cousins, boys, which is the teenagers one, to Phnom Penh, what they said. But since that day, from that then on, we never see them again. We never knew what happened to them. When my father left, they evacuated us from place to place. The last place is in the jungle. So they put us in lorries. The journey lasts for about 2 days. They drop us off at Bo San by the rail track and waiting for the train. All the journey is absolutely terrible because people dying one by one. They just abandon the body on the road. The train came in. We got on the train like a kettle. They just stuffed everyone in the train. And we went to another side of the Cambodian country, which is Battambang. While we were waiting for the train, they searching us. If they found any valuable thing, watches and things, they took it away from you. So when we got to Battambang, they took us to the deep jungle, abandoned there, and they left us to survive ourselves. We didn't have any skill how to build a hut or anything at all. We got bare hand. One by one, many people from the city died of malaria, diarrhea, starvation, mostly children, young children and elderly. The children who came with my family, the skin became yellow. Some of them swollen, some of them like skeleton. So they died one by one. Beautiful children, they all killed them because we are city people. If you are peasant, you're farmer, you'll be a survivor. You got experience to live in that environment. So we're so hungry. They gave us a rice allowance, which is something of 1 can of rice per family. 2 brothers, 1 sister, myself, my mother, and my grandmother. And we mix that rice to make it as a soup. We pick anything from the tree, any leaf from the tree, from the off the ground, make it a food every day. And also they make everyone to work in hard labor. My grand and my mother had to go to collect grass and myself had to go to the forest to cut the tree, everything like that. So experience is hard labor without any food and no medicine. If you're ill, you just hope not to die and hope someone will come and help you. We're not allowed to talk about our past in the city either. We hide our identity. We say we're just a poor servant. My mother was a cleaner and myself just a boy who's selling cigarette or selling bread or newspaper on the street. And I pretend that I can't read or can't write anything at all. That period of time, we just live in the jungle and there's no hope. Every day we look in the sky while we were working, hopefully the aeroplane will come in and drop something for us, or someone come in and take us away from this horrible place.
And was it at this point that you were forced to join the Khmer Rouge?
I've been selected to join a group. I didn't realize it. The group is to join the army, to train to become the Pol Pot army. I didn't want to do it, but I could not refuse it. I had to go with them. They put me in the group of 10 teenagers, a similar age, and to train to become a Pol Pot army. They gave us black uniform. They gave us a gun. So every day we train to crawl on the ground, on the hard ground, under the sun, until we're ready to fight. But I never kill any animal. And when I got that gun in my hand, I shoot in the air. I don't shoot anyone. When they sent me to battlefield twice, each time I didn't shoot anybody. I just hold to the gun like that, pretending I'm shooting. I can hear the bullets pass through me, everything. I just lay myself down on the ground, and hopefully that will go away. We lost the war, and all the Pol Pot soldiers run away. The one in charge abandoned us in the battlefield. So I decided myself, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going back to my mother, my family. Unfortunately, I still got black uniform with me, but I threw the guns, all the guns we got, in the ditch. But we still walk with our black uniform they gave us. As soon as I got into the village by the entrance, how stupid, I went straight through to the main road, easy way in. I should have gone around to the back or something, but I didn't. We just walked, 10 of us, walked through the village, and we got caught by the Vietnamese, and they accusing us that we are Pol Pot soldier. So I've been arrested straight away, tied my hands to the back, and then took me to prison. They tortured me by kicking and asking questions, interrogated me, what my background, my family, everything. Even those, I told them, so I'm not Pol Pot. They didn't believe me. They put me in Vietnamese prison for 2 or 3 months until one day they released us. I mean, when I came out, I got nothing with me at all, only my hope. I hope that I'm going to do something, especially my mother, which is my main concern, that I need to support her. There's no hope for me in Cambodia, no future at all. My mother and myself decided to escape to refugee camp in Thailand. In the refugee camp, I studied hard. I joined the school, which is the American hospital, to train to become a medic or something. Just want to be something. 4 years, no education, complete waste of time, waste of life. And until one day, I had a surprise by the Red Cross, told us that, pack your bag, the car picking you up in a few hours. I said, is that really, really shocking me? It's like you're winning lottery. You have no hope. You just wait in the camp refugee from year to year until 1987, actually. Very fortunate I had permission to come to England by the British people, you know, allow me to have a new life.
And how important is it for you to share your story with us today?
I want everyone to know, the whole world, this could happen if you're not aware of it. In those periods of time, from 1975 to 79, I've been sent to work in the camp, from one camp to another camp. And last one is the camp they built the dike, which is called Drop Beng Thmor. It became a tourist attraction in Cambodia. And when I looked at that tourist attraction, it made me feel very, very sad and angry. That place, with my bare hand, they forced me to work 7 days a week, kicked. I've been punished. Everything on that time, and now become tourist attraction. They did not say anything that in information, this been built by the Cambodian survivor or the people who died in the genocide. No information about that. Every time people go there, have a swim and then enjoy themselves. I remember every single detail, my life experience in the killing field. I feel numb inside. It's scar for life, and this nightmare always in my memories.
You can read more about what happened to Sokpal and his family in his book, The Killing Fields of Cambodia, Surviving a Living Hell, and on our website, hmd.org.uk. I'm joined now by Ramani Sim, who was just 10 years old when she, along with her family, was forced out of Phnom Penh on that day in 1975. This is the first time she has told her story, and she begins by telling us about her life before the Khmer Rouge took over.
In 1975, our family lived in central Phnom Penh. We live in a three-bedroom villa. We are quite affluent family. My dad been director of finance, insurance. My grandfather was a head judge in Phnom Penh itself. So we were very lucky. We had everything from chauffeur, clean, cook, everything you could name of. But also we were very highly educated people. We had doctor, lawyer, and everybody in the family. So I was very fortunate to have lived that life for 10 years before 1975.
So tell us, who was in your family? Did you have brothers, sisters?
I have four older brothers and I am the youngest girl in the family. So starting from 19, 17, 15 and 13 was the youngest one. And I was 10 years old. And obviously, being the youngest girl in the family, I was spoiled rotten. My dad was amazing. He would come home from work, taught my brother how to do woodwork, teach us how to read and write French and Cambodian and storytelling. So we were fluent in French and Cambodian before we even went to school.
And when did you start to notice things changing around you?
The way my mother said is that the war's been raging in Cambodia about a year or two before this. And there was a lot of bombing, a lot of rocket launching into Cambodia, into the outskirts of Phnom Penh. So we had two other family, my youngest auntie and their family came to stay with us because our villa was solidly built. And I could hear the rocket overnight. On the 17th of April, when the Khmer Rouge took over the capital, we managed to hide in our house for 2 days. We just lock up our gate, turn off the light, and just hid inside the house for 2 days, hoping that maybe they will just go away and we can carry on with our life. And my mother, by then, had stocked up so much food in the home that we had bags of rice and dry fish and everything for emergency. So we managed to hide for 2 nights. But in the meantime, we packed up our car with bags of rice and food and water in the car just in case we had to leave. Some of the car were parked inside the garage and some was on the forecourt in our villa. On one day, somebody tried to break the chain to the gate to try to steal our car. And that's when they realized we were still hiding at home. And the soldier came over and said, "You must leave. If you don't leave, we're going to kill you. You'll be shot there and then. And you only need to take a few belongings. You only be going out for 3 days. And then you'll be back." 3 days turned into 4 years of hell.
So that was when you were forced out of your home and had to evacuate the city?
Yes, so we packed up with my auntie and another family of us and just went on the road where they told you to go to. They just block all the road and you just move into like a herd cattle to whatever direction they tell you to go. And from there on, it's just hell on earth because we were moved from a city to work in the labor field, put on the train, squashed. It's so much when I look at what happened to the Jewish people when they were being packed into the train like that. That's exactly what happened to us. We were packed onto the train to the countryside for hard labor. You could never imagine anything like that happen to you. By this stage, we met some of my father's friends who was a general and because he commanded the army and all this, and they just said, "Oh my God, we cannot stay together anymore. Because if we are recognized as a high-ranking official, we'll be shot there and then, and the whole family will be killed as well." Because by then, along the road, they've already started asking the question, what you do and what your family, write your own CV. And people who wrote their CV as their doctor and all this, they get taken away and you can hear the gunshots. So we knew this is what happened. So we cannot tell them the truth and we must split up because if we go as a group with all these well-known people, the whole family is going to be shot. So we start splitting up and they went different directions. We never seen them again. And my mum and auntie and my grandmother came with us and he was head of policeman, my uncle, and she was a doctor in Paris. The day that she came back to Cambodia, bear in mind that she was living and working in Paris for so long, they closed the airport in 1975 and she was pregnant and her child was born during that time and it died straight away. So we split up, carry on. They managed to move us from Phnom Penh to Bat Dambong. I think if you're driving now, it takes you half a day to get there. We only allowed to take what we could, clothes on our back and whatever necessary. They pack you in the train, got to Bat Dambong. And once there, they split you up into groups so that you stay. You have to make your own hat, whatever you can, live on the farm, live on in the field, whatever. There's no housing for you. You make do with what you've got. And you got one day to make your own house. And the next day, we just got to work in the field, hard labor. My brother building dams because heavy workload. And I was 10 at the time. So I stayed with my parent. And my brother was split up to the youth brigade. So they go like a mobile workforce, wherever, whatever need doing, they take them there. There was no food. You can't cook your own food anymore by then. You go to work and you come back and you eat in a commune where they give you food to eat so that you got more time to work. You don't have time to cook. You got more time to work for them. And one time I remember the porridge they gave us, you can count the grain of rice in that bowl of water. And you work from dawn until night. And slowly, one year on, my third brother, he died. And he had to come back to my mum and dad because he's so weak now. And he doesn't care if they don't give him any food because he just need to come back home. And that night, it was full moon. He climbed up the sugar palm tree to drink the sugar juice. And they can see him because of full moon. They can see the shadow of him climbing up there. They waited for him to come out and beat him up. And he died that same night. He was 16 years old at the time. And I always remember that it was just so painful. So he died first. And then my other brother at 17. And the youngest one at 14. Within 1 year, 1.5 years, they died. Because of the hard labor and nothing to eat. My mum watched 3 of them die. October, November, December. And then it followed by my grandmother in January 1977 and my dad in February 1977. I was 12 years old.
And what happened to your father?
Well, we barely survived because my father, having watched 3 sons and his mother die, on that day that he was in the hospital and I was working in the field. And my brother Touchwood was somewhere around, my youngest, my one surviving brother. And I had a girl came running to me, say, quick, 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 your father is dying. They just inject him with water. He's not going to live for long. And so I dropped everything, ran to my dad. He was lying in the hospital, barely there. And he just said to me, look, you are the youngest one, the strongest one, and you will live. But take care of your brother and your mum because they're so weak and they're probably not going to live for long. And he loved me very much. And he passed away. I thought, oh, my God. I just cry and just lie on his chest and we just nothing more we can do. I went to find my brother and my mum to say, look, Dad just passed away. And they came. You know, my mum couldn't do anything anymore by that time. She was so weak. So my brother and I just summoned our strength, dig a grave for him, that just enough to bury him because we didn't have any more strength to dig the grave. We were just so weak ourselves. And just hoping that at nighttime, the wolf didn't knock and dig it up and eat his corpse. And that stayed with me forever.
How on earth did you all carry on through this?
I think 1977, my mum would just say, okay, we can't go on living like this because she was so fresh. She relied on me. You know, they took me away to another camp for the young children to work. And that same night, I will always find my way back to my mum because I just knew she couldn't survive on her own. And my poor mother, she's tried everything to save us. She exchanged her gold, her jewelry, her diamond, just for some food. And if you get caught doing that, they will kill you instantly as well. But by then, it was getting harder and harder for her. And she said, oh, look, I've got some paracetamol left. We money to hide all this stuff because they don't let you stay in the village for long. They keep moving you. Maybe a couple months, they move you to another village. And each time, because we were so weak, we keep dropping off our belonging. We can only walk with what we can carry. So each time we drop off one bit of our belonging, a little piece of another belonging. So basically, this is what they're doing so that you've got nothing left and you're just purely just a workforce. But my mum wanted to hide some picture of my dad and my brothers, and she had some paracetamol left, and she just said, I'm going to kill myself now, and you don't want to be without me either. She planning to kill herself, and I just go along with it. But then she said, oh, but we can't because my brother, my surviving brother is away. What he gonna do if he come back and can't find us? What he gonna do then? Oh, I need to be alive for my brother. And this is how we survived. We survived that 4 years. We don't know when we're gonna be killed or when my mom gonna be alive or there. 4 years of hell. When the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia, we were used as a human shield as well between the two armies. So that is a icing on the cake, isn't it? Well, our story didn't end there either, because when we managed to escape the human shield, my brother has gone. We were separated. So it was only just my mom and I. During that time with the fighting, with the gun shooting in front of us and behind us, and we stuck in the middle, we came across a lake, and my mother could not swim. I could swim because my dad had taught us all to swim. And she said, oh, you must leave me because there's no way you can carry me across that river. I'm too old now. I'm too ill now. I've got no energy. She was a walking skeleton. And I said, no, I can't leave you. So I put her on my back and swam her across the lake to the other side of Buttermore, and that's how it saved our life, because on the other side the fight stopped. So I put her on my back across that lake to the other side, and we got to Buttermore, and my mum went searching for my brother, leave me behind. And for some reason, by miracle, she found him. And my brother was walking on the opposite direction looking for us as well. And they managed to find each other. But my mum and brother by then were too scared to leave in Cambodia in case the Khmer Rouge is still in control. So we decided to follow the people and cross the border to Thailand. And this is another whole level of nightmare. We had to cross the border from Cambodia with the land minefield and people trying to rob us to the refugee camp in Thailand. And there we managed to stay for 3 days. And the Thai government at the time, they were saying that they need money from the West to support the refugee. They put us on a bus back, check us into the Cambodian mountain, Phnom Dong Rek, and you would not believe it. We were right at the top of the mountain. You can see the wire of the landmine hanging on the tree. We literally had to crawl down that mountain. And I remember, this is another nightmare, people were blown up because they landed on the landmine. People were blowing up and we had to walk on their bodies so that we don't get blown up. Oh my good God. I just sort of can't believe this. 4 years, and then we've gone through all this again. Somehow we managed to survive. You know the petrol tanker? We managed to hitchhike on there, sitting on top of the petrol tanker, holding up there. Don't ask me how we managed to stay up there. So we managed to come back to Phnom Penh, went to stay in our house for a little bit. Couldn't stay inside our house because too much memory. We could see all the people that my brother and so on in each room, what they'll be doing. Such a painful memory. So we decided, okay, better go and live in the servant quarter because then there's no memory. And my mum's got a job with the Red Cross to be a translator for the medical team that came to help Cambodia. And from there, she made friends with an English gentleman, Dr. Nick Morris. And he more or less said to us, if you can take yourself out of Cambodia to the Thailand, then we will sponsor you to come to England as a refugee. And this is what we did. We came to Thailand again this time, and Nick, he lives in Oxford, he sponsored us here. But that's how we came to England. My mum could speak a bit of English. My brother and I, nothing. But he was fluent French. I think for him, learning English wasn't too hard. He went to study English in Oxford School of English Language that Nick sent him to. And then from there, he went to Westminster University to do his degree in accounting in IT. And he got a job later on as an IT engineer. And he worked all the time until he retired here. And my mum, she managed to get a job in a hospital as a nursing assistant. But it was so hard for her, you know, apart from Bob War time, she never had to work in her life. So it's a complete shock to her system doing all that hard work again. But she persevered and saved up and bought a house in 6 years after that. My brother got a job and I went to school. I got picked on because I couldn't understand a word of English. But I just thought, oh, well. But I also persevered when I came here. I appreciate everything that we got here. And I became a qualified accountant in the process and have a job ever since. But no, it wasn't easy at all because we were grateful to be here where it's safe and good opportunity. But we also want to be home because Cambodia is our home. And here people don't know anything about Cambodia. They don't care. You're just one of the people. They don't care that you've gone through this. They don't understand how we feel or anything like that. But what can we do? Even now, I would say my mum would have loved to go back to Cambodia and live there, but obviously she can't now, she's too old. I have been to Cambodia a few times as a holiday, and my brother been back to Cambodia once, about 5 years ago, and we went there to make offering to our family that passed away in Battambang, to make offering and to remember them in a temple, and to look at our house one last time. But my brother just never went back. He said too painful for him. And he's not like me. He's not willing to talk at all about what happened. It's too painful for him. My mother would talk to anybody about Cambodia because she wants everybody to know. But their life, my mum's life is stuck. She could not move past what happened because she remembered everything in minute detail what happened to Cambodia back then. So she could not move past that, and she never smiled again. Coming here for 40 years now, she never really laughed or smiled the way that she used to be. For her, her heart is always going to be her children that she lost, her family. It's not just the children, my mum's family, the whole family wiped out. The only one that survived are the one in Paris who came to study. The whole family with their kid, 30 of them, just immediate family, all wiped out. There's 35 of us before board. So only 3 of us came back alive. And for her, she never moved on. Her life is like that. I, on the other hand, I moved on with my life. I couldn't live in Cambodia. Here is my home. But to be honest, I am stuck between two worlds. The color of my skin, the accent that I'm speaking, I will never be English. Yet, I will never be Cambodian because I'm not accepted in Cambodia either. I'm too Westernized for them. But here, I will always be Cambodian. I'm not English. So yes, I am stuck between two worlds, but that's the way it is.
Thank you so much, Ramani, for sharing your story for the first time with us today. What does it mean to you to be able to tell us what happened to you and your family?
Thank you for listening. And I'd love to share the story. I just want it not to be forgotten. And I would wish that it is something that the future generation can learn from it, and hoping that it's not to be repeated, because nobody deserves to go through what we have been through. Right or wrong, war is never an answer to anything. And it must be avoided at all costs, because this is what happened. You go into war, it's the normal people that are going to be killed and not the politician. And nobody win. Nobody win. And it should never be repeated. All this genocide happened in Cambodia, in Rwanda. We just don't learn from our mistake. Keep repeating my mum's story, my story, is that people don't forget the genocide. Whatever happened, this is what I'm hoping for today, that people will listen and learn from it, from a survivor like me.
Today, Ramani works as an accountant, and no one would guess if they met her what she has overcome in her life, a trait she shares with all of the survivors who have agreed to talk to us in this series. That's all for this episode. My thanks, of course, to Ramani and Sokpal for their time today. In episode 4, our survivor story comes from Rwanda, when 100 days of bloodshed devastated the country.
The genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda broke the world's most atrocious records in the speed of killing civilians.
When a group of militia came looking for me, normally when you were taken away like that, the chances of surviving were almost below zero.
Thank you for joining me today. Goodbye for now. Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today, and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.